Just to make sure I haven't overwhelmed you with archetype, dream images are not simply replays of the past. They seem to have a life of their own. Jung simply tried to explain that by creating a term to say that there's something in us shaping those images as much as experience shapes them. So it's the confluence of these two factors. That developed a little further to where that archetype, that image-shaping factor, appears to have a foreknowledge of your entire life. That's another word for spirit. And that archetype is not something inside. It's apparently also connected with the material world. That's a big deal. But I'm trying to give you an introduction to some of the vocabulary.
Can I ask one quick question?
Yeah.
Jung makes a big deal of it. He wanted to see that the archetypes were the same, I guess, across the globe. And he talks about he wanted to investigate in Washington, D.C., I guess he met them among the Negroes and so forth. So if the archetypes, what is it about when they're the same, and yet I think you're saying that they are different for each individual?
Yes, that's all I can say. It's a paradox.
How are they, well, this part quickly, how are they the same?
Well, because there seems to be a perceptual similarity in the way we respond to mother, the way we respond to love, the way we respond to fight, flight. And yet there's a difference because they seem to convey an individual message. I think where we're going will partly answer that question, because the self now is going to come into our discussion.
Okay.
I just want to make sure you're okay with the archetype. I just want to make sure I didn't lose anybody on that. You're okay? You would tell me if you were okay? Okay.
It's slippery.
It's slippery.
One minute, I think I have a little bit of a draft for the meeting.
I think the easiest thing to realize is that Jung is just saying there is another factor which we have never known before shaping us. It's not instinct. It's something else. Well, he just gives that a word.
So, in a way, you shouldn't literalize this term so much. But always don't have a major
process. He's just naming a process that has never been named before.
That's as big as the unconscious, though. I mean, when you go to this,
yeah.
This is big.
Yeah. And there's nothing in our paradigm that says there is a knowledge in nature of the future. But it is so clear, if you do this work, that there is. And great physicists, great scientists, are aware of that and are letting their world be rocked. Yes?
It's my liberalism that I want to make connections to things, but isn't it in some ways people talk about God's will or that the nature of things? I mean, throughout eons,
right.
People have had to come up with something that remains that it, whatever that it is.
Yeah. We'll talk about that a little bit further today, and then also in the very last one of the series, what this all has to do with God. It does. But let's worry about the archetype first before we deal with God. Okay, we're going to move on to the last typical part of the personality. Remember? That's how we started. Shadow, anima animus, persona. We took a detour into archetype. We took a detour into energy. The last part is what Jung calls the self. Shadow was images of your own sex you don't like. Animus, images of the opposite sex you do. Persona was fastidious attention to clothing, to appearance, to actors. The self is symbolized by images of symmetry, circles, squares, diamonds, jewels, pearls, and by what Jung calls superordinate images, gods, heroes, big, you know, Reggie Millers, big jocks, idolized by a community would fit here as well. I think the easiest thing to say to get us going is that the self is a portrait of the real you. It's an image of genuine identity. The self is who you are. But it's not a state, it's a process. And we'll be looking at the nature of that process. Jung talked about five basic functions of this part of ourselves called the self, symbolized by images of symmetry and superordinate personalities. The way it works is to create you through the synthesis of conflict.
Say that again.
Its job is to create you through the synthesis of conflict. The way it... Conflict. The way it starts is, and the way it's first experienced, is as conflict. You see, he's giving much different twist to conflict. Conflict is not something bad. Conflict is the way you come into knowledge of who you are. He completely turns our normal understanding of it upside down. You need conflict to discover yourself, because the self, your identity, is formed as that conflict is resolved through an image of synthesis generated by the self.
Is it the
outer conflict or inner? Either way. We've learned already that there's no difference.
Okay. So it doesn't matter if you have a conflict with somebody.
Typically speaking, it's inner, but I would not want to limit it. Now remember what I started with, Jung's night sea journey, his dark period. He saw himself falling apart. He saw himself coming back together. When he came back together, he began to realize, I have a new sense of my mission in life, a new sense of self-confidence, and this new sense was accompanied by those images that I just mentioned. We'll look at some dreams to express this. But I'm just now, for the moment, trying to give you a kind of a theoretical introduction to what this self-image is about. And I think this is the big thing, as far as Jung is concerned, that I mentioned earlier, his big discovery, that if we are in a mess, something gets going inside us to bring us back together, and that is inborn. And that's the self. That's, if you will, the archetype of synthesis. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at the self. Yes?
If it's a process to reach your genuine self.
Right.
And kind of part of getting on that path is the synthesis of conflict. Is it fair to say that some people don't experience enough conflict?
Yes.
Legitimately get on the path?
Or...
I ask because I have friends who, you know, are curious about my readings or what I'm doing. And they feel sort of an interest, but can't understand any desire.
There are happy carrots in the world. But none of them are probably here. We wouldn't be drawn to this if we weren't somehow dealing with it. And I think, you know... You might envy them, but when you've been through this and you see what it leads to, I would prefer the root of conflict. But either they're not in conflict.
So you just have to resolve that they can't get on that path and still.
Yeah.
Such as they.
You can't force people. No, you can't force people.
Isn't there work to be done in the first half of life and the second half of life that's totally different?
That's yes.
That, you know, until the ego is developed, until we do the responsible things that we are supposed to do, you know, that it's not time for this work.
Traditionally, Jung said this stuff started at 35. But I know I've seen people at 18.
Happening earlier.
It's happening much earlier. So if you're lucky, you know, I guess you could say, quote unquote, you can sail through life without having to deal with this. But then, in a way, you're not so lucky, because I think what you discover in this harder path is far more interesting. And it keeps you alive and happier longer. But it's harder. And yes, there are people either who don't have it or have it and deny it. And you certainly can't push the river. It's a hard lesson. And people who are on this journey lose friends and make new friends. Because the other way just seems so boring. Yeah, Sandy.
Did you use the term archetype of
synthesis? Synthesis.
So you would use, somehow I don't understand the archetype.
All these figures, the shadow, the anima, the animus, the persona.
So synthesis would be a figure?
No, a characteristic. All these figures are archetypes. The anima, shadow, animus, persona, and the self.
To me, synthesis is a verb, and we're an archetype is a noun. I can't quite...
Oh, archetype's a verb.
Huh?
Archetype is a verb.
So you archetype something? You
well, you get archetyped.
I never thought of that.
Yeah. Well, it's really both, but I mean, it's a dynamic concept.
Okay. I can follow that.
Yeah. So next time you're mad, say, oh, go archetype yourself. I'll give you examples of all of these. Another dimension of the self is that it's an image of your center. And we just say that, I'm centered. Another aspect is that it's a representation of your totality. It's who you are completely. These are just different facets of the same thing. Another aspect of it is that it is your ground plan, that there really is a road for you to be walking. And this is what the self personifies. There, for Jung, you see, identity is a priori, prior to experience. This self is there before you're born. And what you do is you discover it. You lose it, and then you recover it. And the last feature of the self is that it is non-ego. It is not an I. It is something that leads you as an I. So what Jung starts getting into is a reversal of centrality. The I, what we normally think of as Gary, is no longer simply in charge, but is attentive to and following the intimations of another side of myself. This becomes the guide, and I become the guided.
The ego first, so higher self.
Right. The self. Definitely.
So, are you saying the self is like, the self is bigger than I am? The self encompasses more than I am?
Yes.
Right.
It's everything.
It's everything.
Yeah. It's the way he kind of describes it is it's a infinitely small point and an infinitely large circle. We are contained in it. The ego is simply a reflection of that. If it's a healthy ego, we are a reflection of who we are. If it's an unhealthy ego, we are not a reflection of who we are. So all these steps we've been talking about, shadow, blah, 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 see, they're all sub-parts of the journey. And what we're trying to get to is what is behind all of this. It's the birth of our real personality. That's a little bit answer to your question, Ted, that the archetypes we've talked about are in the service of this. They may be universal potentials, but they are orchestrated individually. And an individual permutation. But it is a paradox. Now let's look at a dream. Section 10. Let me see. I'm trying to think of time. Well, Let me just summarize the first, well, it might be quicker, just read the first two yourself. That'll save some time. Okay? In the first one, you see the fragmentation, the lost is this back and forth. It's a man who's lost. And the way he's walking back and forth in the dream is the way he's walking back and forth in life. He doesn't know what the heck he's doing. Then he begins to look at all his different pieces, and that's what the ViewMaster disc contains. He's beginning to look at all these fragmented tendencies in his life and trying to see them as a whole, and that ViewMaster disc is the beginning of a self-image. So the psyche generates a understanding or the capacity of understanding into which all his pieces can fit. That's what the self does. It's a bigger sense of himself that organizes what previously felt was felt as fragmenting. Yeah. Oh, I could say the unconscious for the sake of our discussion. Yeah. By psyche, Jung really means conscious and unconscious working together. But I think we can say unconscious for our purposes. Remember, I'm just trying to get you started with some vocabulary here. So there is the self as an image of totality. The next dream is a self as an image of the center. The woman was in a period of professional disorientation and was asking herself, what work will really make me happy? And she had this dream. And what the dream shows is her fetching water out of the center. Again, out of the self, and her husband is, and was in fact, supportive of her inquiry. This is how these questions show up in dreams. Centers or larger circles into which things fit or which represent a center of interest. The next one, yeah, maybe you could just read it too quietly for the sake of time. And this is a picture of what she calls Matisse's Rite of Spring. Actually, it's not Rite of Spring. It's called Dance. Read the next two, the last two. Okay. More time. The dreamer was recovering from rape. She had been raped. And I included the first dream to give you, so that's what the accident is, right? And I included it, first of all, to show you the circle. Second of all, to show you the superordinate personality. That goddess figure would be a self that she is trying to reestablish with because the rape blew her apart. But the real telltale sentence is in the last dream. I am relearning a process of seeing life from the inside out. That is looking at who am I first, and then how do I live in the world as the person that I know I am. In those moments, you get dreams like goddesses representing her individuality as she tries to put her life back together again. Now there is an image of a totality, a viewmaster, of the center, the pool of water, and the superordinate figure, the goddess, and all in the context of looking at life from the inside out. Who am I? Not what does the world look like and where do I fit in, but who am I? And I'll find the place in the world for me. Another very frequent image of the self is the mandala. I thought we'd spend a little time on that. Mandala is, of course, it's a symmetrical image. It's Sanskrit for magic circle. The original use of mandalas were as images of religious meditation. But Jung found they appear very often in dreams when the issue of the self is being dealt with. We've seen, in a way, two mandalas already, probably three, the viewmaster disc, the pool of water that she was dipping into the center, and the dance of Matisse. So I brought along several pictures just to kind of give you a sense of the image. And I would say probably this is the most frequent image in dreams, these circles. These, of course, are used, these are images from religious traditions, but we'll see some examples of them as inner statements as well. That's Buddhist. They're known in all traditions, but primarily in the East, although that's... is that the focus? I can't see. Is that in focus? Okay. Buddhist as well. Christian. So you got this circle. And Christ and Mary and Holy Spirit. Christian again, that's disciples at the Pentecost. I think that's Russian Orthodox, Native American. That form is known in all traditions. Egyptian. Anyone see the mandala in that one? You know that painting? Guernica? Paul Tillich said it's the painting that modern theology has to come to grips with. It's a little surprise. See it right there? Yeah. Right there.
Oh.
Which suggests that there's ultimate healing. I mean, it's a very powerful picture, I find, in that regard. No matter how bad the fragmentation of our time, the bombing of Guernica, there is healing.
What does Paul Tillich say about that?
That it's the painting that modern theology has to address. How can that be in a world ruled by God? Jung stumbled on this through his own journey. When he left Freud and got disoriented, he began painting, and this is the very first one he painted. I think it's 1916. Just did it intuitively, but then began to realize, oh, this self has been behind this collapse and rebuilding all along. It's another one of his. These are all, they're dreams connected with these, but given our time limitation, I just decided to show you the pictures, but each of these could take quite a bit of time. They're all very significant. There, I think you can see how the self is integrating the shadow, is giving the standpoint by which he can integrate the shadow, or the rawness of whatever that dragon is. See the mandala in the center? I think that's the shadow on the right. Because the self needs, now all these parts we've talked about, the self, they are all parts of the self. And what the self does is give them a coordination so they begin to work as a unified whole. Another one of his.
So if you had a mandala in a dream, would it be more of a self-dream then?
Yeah. Now I brought, these are, this is from a series of 20 pictures that Jung published of a patient, and I just brought along three to kind of show you again how it functions in an individual. I showed you cultural mandalas just to kind of familiarize you with the form, because what we're looking at is how they show up. Now this is a little hard to see because the colors don't come across well, but that is, that's purple. Now, do you remember Roy G. Biv? Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Colors of the rainbow. See, red and violet are two opposite extremes. And you see how they're coming together here? The red is pushing itself into the violet. So there's an image of the mandala drawn by somebody who's beginning to heal and synthesize polarity that was once felt as conflicting. That's how it looks in an individual. And you see, as then the unification, the synthesis takes place, a light is born. That light would be the awareness of a new sense of confidence and identity and individuality and meaning. And then you see how it radiates out and begins to affect the environment. So that this is really the social dimension of our work. You become a different person with something to give, something of unique individual value. It involves a long inner process, but the ultimate goal is a new outer relationship as well as a new inner, as well as a new inner sense. It's a trick question. Do you know who painted that?
Yeah.
No. It's a vitamin C crystal. Magnified 125 times. Nature uses the same building block as the psyche. Again, Jung, at the end of his life, was very much interested in the parallel between our inner world and the material world. Last subject. What does all this have to do with religion? We've seen that one of the main images that the self uses in its self-representation is an image of God. Jung called, in other words, that Jung gave for the self is the God image. because images of God are very frequently what are used to symbolize the self. And this got him reflecting on the relationship between religion and this inner process of growth, because there is such a parallelism of symbolism. For example, St. Bonaventure says God is an intelligible sphere whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. God and the images of the self, God, descriptions of God and descriptions of the self overlap. And it's not only Christian. Parmenides, a 5th century BC, a pre-Socratic philosopher, said God is a circle consisting of glowing light. If you just take the Christian tradition, some of the characteristics we've seen of the self, that it's a source, a central source, is also reflected in the image of Christ, where Christ says, I am the vine, you are the branches. This idea of the self as uniting symbol, uniting opposites, is reflected in Christ saying, I'm Alpha and Omega. We've seen that the self is represented as images of symmetry, often in multiples of 4, 8, 12, 16, and you have that number parallel in the Christian description of Christ. 12 disciples, 4 arms of the cross. Other mandalas in the Christian representation of Christ and redemption is the pearl of great price, the mustard seed, treasure buried in the field, and the heavenly city in the book of Revelation. So Jung wasn't going to let that go by without comment, and just observed that there seems to be, psychologically speaking, a parallel in the change that this process works on an individual compared to what has been described by believers in a religious tradition with the change that is worked on them through their process of revelation and redemption. The another factor that is parallel between the process of coming to terms with the self and traditional understanding of religion is that the role of the will is reevaluated. St. Paul, not I, but Christ who liveth in me. And in Jung, the ego is in service to the self. The will is important. It brings you up to an experience, but it doesn't carry you through the experience. All religious traditions talk about the guidance of God, and we've seen that the self has this aspect of guidance and leading you forward. All religious traditions describe religion as the religious experience as an awesome one, and the emotions that accompany registering the self are often felt to be overpowering. Jung just makes the observation, isn't this interesting? He's not trying to say this is a religious process. But I think particularly for people who have lost an ability to believe and feel any meaning in a traditional religious framework, this process of transformation gives much of the same experience that used to be attributed to traditional traditional religious life. So he felt it was very important that we honor this experience as the highest value in a period of growth, to be able to devote ourselves to this and allow ourselves to be carried along in the way we've been talking about today. He was also very critical of traditional religions, and I think for the sake of time, I'm not going to get into it at the moment. We will do so later down the line if you want to come back. But just be aware that he's also not just affirming everything that's been in contemporary religions, particularly Christianity. He was very, very critical of Christianity. But he did feel that there was an inborn religious process in the personality. Whatever else religions may be doing, he felt they were at least coming out of this dimension of experience where the ego is reevaluated. And that could not be ignored. So he spent certainly the latter part of his life reflecting on what this psychological process says about religion and what religion can learn about the psychological process, a dialogue. The last thing we're going to look at is alchemy. This process of synthesis was something he stumbled on in himself, but as I mentioned, but then he began looking around him in myths of the world to see, was there any other place in myth that described growth and change in the same set of images of fragmentation and synthesis that he had seen in himself? Well, one big place he went for parallels to this process, for images symbolizing a process of fragmentation and synthesis, was in medieval alchemy. Now, medieval alchemy, depending on how you define it, some people would say it started back in ancient Egypt. But when the Arabs conquered that part of the world, they took it to their countries. Alchemica is the same as Al-Qaeda, it's the same Al. It was given its name alchemy in the Arabian countries, brought back to Europe through the Crusades somewhat, and then up from the Muslim countries in through Spain and France. So by about the 16th century, it has taken hold in Europe. And what it was many surprisingly intelligent people, many of them lawyers, doctors, judges, preachers, spent an enormous amount of time trying to turn some worthless piece of material into some valuable piece of material, gold, diamond, a magical substance that bestowed healing. The end points were variously described. But they chopped, literally spent hours and hours, days, months, years in their laboratories trying to turn this material into gold. Now, this was a pre-scientific attempt. So they were not writing in chemical formulas, but in mythological language. So they wouldn't say, take 2 grams of mercury and 3 grams of sulfur. They would say, take Hermes at the full moon and chop up Hermes and add Venus when the Mars and Venus are, whatever, put them together. They gave a symbolic account of this process that they thought was a change of material substances. But they never succeeded, as far as we know, in making gold or diamond. You see, here it has a chemical component and a philosophical component. Prayer, study, and chemical work, in their mind, was all necessary for the completion. Jung collected alchemical texts out of his own dreams, giving him inspiration, and simply began studying all the images they used to describe their chemical transformation. See, this is actually a recipe book. There, the material that's being chopped up is thought of as a god being chopped up. You begin to notice, these are frequent dream images. It's a very frequent dream image. Dismemberment. And he reached the conclusion, there is one of his notebooks where he studied text after text, simply trying to decipher, was there any order in what these alchemists were describing? His conclusion is what they were doing was projecting an inner process of transformation onto a material process. There was no change going on in that matter in the way they were experiencing it, but their experience was colored by the fact that they were projecting their own process of transformation onto this material substance. So by studying their writings, Jung came up with a kind of lexicon for all the images that the psyche, the unconscious, can use as it generates healing by taking a person in a fragmented state of mind and synthesizing them into a whole new person. Beethoven fits here, I think. There's another one of his books. Well, the last series I brought along is one alchemical recipe where the author described what he thought was going on in the material substance, and let's look at it and you'll see what Jung made of it. So this, in that author's mind, is the first stage of his recipe. We might say, you know, take some flour and sugar. He is saying taking a fountain and under the right constellation of star and moon and sun, begin separating the pieces of material that are in that, the polarity that's inherent in that material, out. And there's a masculine component and there's a feminine component. Of course, for Jung now, this is a metaphor that, just like in our guy's dream where he saw two, a male and a female, what the alchemist is doing is showing us images of how his own transformation would look. And what he's going to do is picture opposites which unite, synthesize, and give birth to a new state. In the alchemist's mind, this is going on in the material. There's a king and a queen inside the lead about to unite. In Jung's mind, it's a personification of the developmental process of synthesis. Separation and then uniting. And that's the basic paradigm of alchemy. They unite. Now you can see already the sexual symbolism here is pronounced, and this gave Jung cause to go back to Freud, who took all sexual images in dreams as about sex. Jung said sometimes they're about sex, sometimes they're a metaphor. Sometimes they're a metaphor for this process of synthesis. So uniting all, calling all sexual images sexual, misses this same process. They die. And there is an effect. Now, in the alchemist's mind, that would be the effect of the cooking on a new stage of the material. As far as Jung is concerned, that effect is the beginning of the therapeutic effect of what the person is going through, taking this as a projection. So, again, what he's seeing here is what he considers the basic drive of the personality, which is union. Not purely sexual union a la Freud, but an inner union using often true sexual imagery, but in the service of the production of a new center. That would represent, in Jung's interpretation, but the beginning of the healing in the conscious mind. This going on in the unconscious. Then there's a return, and there's a synthesis on the unconscious level as well. The alchemists very often depicted that redeemed condition in religious imagery. And for Jung, that is just one more confirmation that this process is about the self. So he studied alchemy. Really, this was his main business, studying alchemy. He published 3 books on it. Second in our series of upcoming workshops, we'll focus on one of those books. Just to look at all the range of symbolism the alchemists used to describe this process, because we can then take that to help us understand what part of the process we are in if we're working with it psychologically. Finito. Questions? We have about 10 minutes.
Is it known what the alchemy was like before the death of you? And what major transformations it was?
I don't know how much is known. Certainly some is known of Arabic alchemy.
So did it already have that form?
I think it's pretty similar. And the idea is that alchemy is an outgrowth of Egyptian embalming symbolism, because what they were trying to do was make an everlasting body, and what the alchemists did was take that and try to make an everlasting substance. But the history, I think the history of science would say embalming symbolism to Hellenistic alchemy, that's the Greek, Greco-Egyptian world. Arabs come in, they take it to the East, it comes back to Europe as the alchemy we know it. Jung picks it up and sees it as a metaphor for personal growth.
Can you help me a little more on symmetry? Earlier you talked about circles and triangles and such, but I'm not quite there on, I guess, the mandala, circles, so. Because I don't find you dreaming about triangles. I'm trying to figure out what you're
Triangles are different.
Symmetry.
Well, it's he would call image of symmetry multiples of 4. So 3 is different. It's not quite 4.
So it's in the symmetry category or not?
Heading that way, but got some problems.
Okay.
1/4 missing. And usually it's the last 4th that's the biggest struggle. He wrote essays on the symbolism of 3 and 4. I hesitate to get us too confused, but it is significant. And there is a big difference. Sandy.
I have a question. If anybody would like to be on the Friends of Jung mailing list and hear about these classes as they're starting to come up, if I don't have your email, can you give it to me? I have a pen and paper here, right here. So when you, Gary's done, if you could give me your email, I'll put you on the mailing list.
Thank you. Oh, by the way, the date's wrong. It's not, I said January, February 2006. It should be 2007. The back sheet there. Yes,
yeah. I had a question that came up in your Thursday night.
Parallel, yeah. I think this will be what we talk about in the Saturday on Ion. I think it's the 3rd in the fall. To be very concise, this theme of separation and union It's a classic process of inner growth, and Jung saw the same thing going on in history. And that now in history we are in a period where synthesis is the next challenge.
And that would be the same in Eastern philosophy as the
one that the relationship between the East and the West, it seems that the images that are coming up now for people who are actually making this shift in themselves is a mixture of Western and Eastern imagery. Yes. Eastern and Gnostic. Other questions?
One question is,
I think if you were lucky enough to have healthy parents, you probably don't have to do that. But if you have had unhealthy influences, you've become somebody else besides who you were meant to be. And the difficult part of the work is that first has to be destroyed. I think that's the fragmentation. That's why it had the old has to go first. But I think if you were lucky to have a parent who saw who you were and helped you become who you were rather than who they thought you should be, which is a big deal, if you had that, no, maybe you don't have to. Peers, school.
I'm not seeing any way to get away from this fragmentation. I mean, no matter how good your parents are, 9/11 still happened to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Iraq still happened to all of us. I don't see any way to get away from
this. But then when you like to think of it, then you're thinking of it.
I mean, probably, you know, if you are, you're not going to be doing this inner work if you were happy with the way you are completely. So that it, by the nature of how we're drawn to this, something in us has to die. Because we know somehow that we want to be something other than we've been taught to be. Certainly, I think we're in a period of great change. We have to be. We are getting so close as nations with communications, so close with each other. It's now a world market. We have to understand new pressures. Kids now are getting out of college or competing with kids in New Delhi for tech jobs. All this is new. And the pressures for us to change are a level of awareness are probably requiring at least some of us to try to understand how does the individual need to develop to keep up with the times and to creatively address.
There's a whole other piece, too, about the parent image. The image that we had as Christians of God was, you know, so archetypically the father image.
Right.
Came out of that. Oh, judgment and
that will be addressed eventually as we get
right
down the road.
But, I mean,
the inadequacy of
our biological parent, that image of the parent.
The cosmic parent is also way inadequate.
We don't even have a feminine aspect.
No, we don't. Anything else? Thanks for hanging in there. I appreciate your coming.